Back from recess, and we are ready to continue taking testimony on Senate Bill 485. Jennifer, bring your group up, please. Thanks. And I would, I go through the names, and I'm afraid I'd butcher them so bad I'd embarrass myself, so. But state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
I'm into the microphone.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Steve Piucci. I am an attorney in Portland, and I will defer to these other gentlemen for the time being.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm Dave O'Connor from Malala.
Mr. Chair, honorable members of this committee, I'm Daniel DeZuba from Portland, Oregon. And I think, with the committee's permission, I've been asked to go first.
Please go ahead.
I am an attorney in private practice. I have, for the past 20 years, represented injured workers, many of whom were hurt on jobs that came under the Employer Liability Act. And what I wanted to talk to you about is the employer liability law. I've heard some testimony about that law in this proceeding, which I think is not accurate. And so I'd like to spend a little time to tell you a little bit about the background of the law, how it interplays with the workers' compensation system, and what Section 17 through 20, what effect that they will have on it. First of all, the employer liability law is not part of the workers' compensation law. It was passed 3 years before the workers' compensation law. It was actually passed by the voters in 1910 through the initiative process. And the basic rationale for the employer liability law is that the cost of safeguards for workers should be just as much a cost of doing business as cost protecting plant and equipment. And what the employer liability law provides is that employers who are in charge of dangerous work must take the necessary precautions to safeguard workers or be responsible in damages if they fail in this duty. And that's what the employer liability law says. A person who is injured on the job does not have to choose between an employer liability law claim or a workers' compensation claim. Actually, they are remedies that complement each other. I think I should give you just a little explanation of what a third-party case is. I practice in Portland, Oregon. If I ask my secretary to go across the street to the courthouse, and she does, and on the way across the street, she's in the crosswalk, she's hit by a car that runs a red light, she is entitled to workers' compensation benefits under the laws of the state. She also is entitled to bring a lawsuit against the driver that was negligent and that hurt her. One of the reasons that she may want to do that is that, historically speaking, and I think this covers really all 50 states, workers' compensation benefits have been very narrow, they do not cover all the losses that are involved in a case. For example, say somebody makes $40,000 a year and they're 30 years old. We could have a construction worker. And let's say that person is going to work till they're 60. We won't have any raises just for ease of handling. So they make $40,000 a year. So they have a back injury on the job. And because of that, they can only do minimum wage jobs. And that happens quite a bit. Somebody that doesn't have a great deal of education is used to working with their body. So they can only make a minimum wage or, say, $20,000 a year. So they've lost $20,000 a year because of that back injury. And over the 30 years that they'd be working, $20,000 times 30 years is $600,000. And that's what their losses would be in just earning capacity, not much to mention pain and suffering or something of that nature. But under Oregon's workers' compensation system, they would receive about $36,000 in permanent disability benefits, and they're cut loose. There is nothing that really helps them. They may be entitled to some vocational services for a year or a year and a half, but then that's the end of it, and that's the end of the employer's responsibility in terms of their future loss of earning capacity. And so that's why the people turn to third-party cases. If we go back to my secretary, she has an injury. She is entitled to have her medical benefits paid for. She's entitled to receive time loss, which is a portion of her wages, until her condition becomes stable. And then if she has a permanent disability, she's entitled to a permanent disability award. And those are her benefits. And my workers' compensation carrier, which is an Oregon company, would pay those benefits. But she's also entitled to bring an action against the other driver and seek full damages. Medical bills, past lost wages, past future impairment of earning capacity. So she's not limited to whatever the workers' compensation law provides. She is able to recover the damages that she actually has actually suffered and can prove. She's also entitled to damages for such things as pain, suffering, inability to do the things off the job that she used to do. So she has those two parallel rights. And under the law, the workers' compensation law, actually, the money that she has received in benefits from the workers' compensation carrier is paid back out of the settlement that she gets from the other driver by a formula that's set forth by statute. So we have a workers' compensation case and a third-party case, and that's the general interplay. Now, she would not be entitled to benefits. She would not be able to bring a case under the employer liability law because her work did not involve risk and danger. Only about, probably less than 1% of on-the-job injuries result in an employer liability law case, and she could not do that. The employer liability law has a certain logic to it. The logic is the people that are in charge of dangerous work have the responsibility to take the necessary safeguards. And it comes up in two settings. One, where the employer, it cannot be the person's direct employer or own employer. My secretary could not hit me, or could not sue me for an injury that happened on the job, with some very narrow exceptions, because the social bargain that we made when we passed workers' compensation in 1913 is that you cannot sue your own employer if your employer has workers' compensation insurance. So a person that's hurt on the job cannot sue their own employer. In the usual context of an employer liability law case, arises on a construction project with multiple contractors. And it happens under two situations. One is where the one of the employers, to be liable under the employer liability law, you have to be an employer of somebody. That's why homeowners are not going to ever be liable under the employer liability law, because they don't employ anybody. Okay. You have to be an employer of somebody. And so often you'll see a general contractor that controls a job site and is in charge of the work. I can give you an example from my own practice. I represented a woman named Belinda Johnson, who was 37 years old in October of 1997, and she was working as a roofer on a warehouse project, and she's 30 feet above the ground. She had to work. She's a single mother of five that was supporting her family. Her husband was incarcerated, and she worked for a roofing contractor. And a month before she was hurt, and there were skylights up on this warehouse, and it was 30 feet to the ground. And a month before she was hurt, one of the workers on the job fell through a skylight, but fortunately landed on some shelving and was not hurt seriously. And so what the general contractor did, who was in charge of the job by contract and required the subcontractors to comply with its rules and its safety codes, what the general contractor did was it put plywood under some but not all of the skylights, and you couldn't tell which of the skylights had plywood underneath it because they were smoked over. And as a misfortune would have it, she fell through a skylight that wasn't protected by plywood. She fell some 30 feet. She suffered fractured skull. She suffered facial fractures. She suffered brain damage. She suffered blindness in her left eye and a loss of vision in her right eye. She suffered broken fractures to both wrists and a broken left kneecap. And so she's blind and she's brain damaged, and she's trying to live on workers' compensation benefits and support her family. Now, under Oregon law, benefits for permanent and total disability are very hard to get. And if you do get them, if you do qualify for them, you receive a pension. But in recent history, there has been a tightening of eligibility. For example, in 1988, 195 people received benefits for permanent and total disability. In 1999, 13 people received benefits for permanent and total disability. And the people that receive benefits for permanent and total disability cannot do any work, even part-time work, at a minimum wage. For example, my office represented a lady who could do telemarketing on a part-time basis for $5 an hour, and she was found not to be entitled to benefits for permanent and total disability, and her name is Betty T. So in the Belinda Johnson case, I brought an action for her, and we filed a workers' compensation case. She receives benefits for Safe Corporation for permanent and total disability. If this law had been in effect, there's a real question in my mind whether we could have gotten her the settlement that we did. And I'll tell you why. Under most cases in Oregon, you walk down the street, you get hit by a car, you bring a lawsuit. We have what's known as pure form comparative negligence. The jury is asked to fill out a questionnaire at the end of the case. It usually says, was the defendant negligent, the person that was sued? Was the plaintiff negligent? What is the respective percentage of the negligence of the parties? And so if the plaintiff is 50% or less negligent, the amount of the plaintiff's recovery is reduced by their percentage of negligence. So if somebody is hit by a car, the jury awards $20,000, the jury finds that the plaintiff is 50% negligent, the verdict for the person is reduced to $10,000. Pretty simple math. But under Oregon law, if a person is 51% negligent, they can't recover. Now, under the law of the state of Alaska, every case, not just serious injury cases or cases like the employer liability law, but every case is governed by pure form comparative negligence. Under the law of the state of Washington, every case is governed by pure form comparative negligence. Under the law of the state of California, every case is governed by pure form comparative negligence. And personally, I think that pure form comparative negligence is the most just way to approach things. And the reason is this. Under pure form comparative negligence, every person bears exactly the percentage of his share of the damages. If somebody is 10% at fault, they pay 10% of the damages. If the plaintiff is 10% at fault, their damages are reduced by 10%. If they're 90% at fault, their damages are reduced by 90%. But I don't live in a perfect world in terms of my practice. In Oregon, only the employer liability law has pure form comparative negligence. Now, that means that if a jury were to find Belinda Johnson was 51% negligent, she could not recover for that terrible tragedy that happened to her, then she would be stuck trying to raise a child, or five children, on the modest pension she would get for permanent and total disability. And Safe Corporation, a local insurer, would not receive back the money that it has paid for her injury. And what happens, practically speaking, is this. If a defendant knows that you could lose. They could argue in her case. They could say she didn't watch where she was going. We know we're responsible. We know that you may not be found negligent at all. But we know that there's a great risk, and you can't take that risk. So we're going to give you, we'll offer you 25 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. And that's how it works in practice. But because there's pure form comparative negligence, and because she was injured so badly, and because the defendant knew it was going to have to respond in damages, it gave her a full settlement of its policy limits. And out of that money, we paid back Safe Corporation $486,000 for the benefits which it had paid. One other example of how the employer liability law might come up. Yes.
We've got a long ways to go tonight. We understand your issue is with the Employer Liability Act part of this bill. You haven't mentioned any of the rest of it.
That's it, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you very much for bringing this issue forward. Let's let some of the people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and senators on this panel. Thanks for having us come and listening to us. As I said before, my name is Steve Piucci. I'm a trial lawyer from Portland. I'm currently the president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and as you probably understand already, we oppose this bill. I will briefly speak to the employer liability law aspect of it, not going over any of what Mr. DeZuba has said, but my point is this. Workplace safety is at risk in Oregon. And it is already not a safe place to be. And what we're talking about is, as Dan said, essentially construction site multi-employer situations where a general contractor or some other employer has control over the job site. And they have control over job sites because Oregon OSHA regulations, our safety code, makes them have control. One of the prime and first sections of that of OSHA in the construction code section says you can't delegate this duty of safety and you can't delegate your responsibility to follow the safety rules that we have here in Oregon if you're a general contractor. And anyway, at any rate, as Mr. DeZuba was saying, currently if a plaintiff such as David O'Connor, my client who's sitting here, and you'll hear from soon. If he were to be deemed 51% negligent by a jury in an employer liability law case, he would get 49% of his damages. If the bill, Senate Bill 485, as proposed regarding the employer's liability law, changes and becomes law, if he were to be deemed 51% liable by a jury, he would get $0. That would mean that the 49% liable general contractor in his case would pay nothing. That would also, and by the way, we did settle this case, and I can offer this to you that the current state of affairs on the employer liability law, in the very few cases that there are, actually promotes settlements and avoids litigation. The reverse will be true. You will be forced to trial. You will have more litigation. There are, earlier we testified at the MLAC committee, and I'm pleased to see that at least it is recognized that there is a financial impact to this portion of the bill. I'd have to say that there are costs to everybody involved if this bill becomes law. There are costs to workers, obviously. There are costs to workers' compensation carriers, insurers, Safe, Liberty Northwest, all the others. And there are costs to employers. And I just want to explain to you how it works and it has worked for Dave O'Connor. When Mr. O'Connor tipped a scissor lift into an uncovered hole at the Beaverton Mall, he fell 15 feet and he fractured his vertebrae and he has a crushed spinal cord. Safe Corporation has paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars to retrain him, to pay for his care, and for time loss benefits. David's now an electrical estimator with Oregon Electric Company and doing quite well. As you can see, he no longer gets around as well, though. In that case, the workers' compensation carrier, Safe, projected a $700,000 lifetime costs of theirs, which is called a lien. And under the employer's liability law, their lien gets paid back. And there is a formula, as Mr. DeZuba explained. In David's case, because he knew there was a trench there, though he was working at 20 head height at 20 feet on a scissor lift, pulling wire through ceiling joists, and couldn't see the trench because it was poorly lit and there were shadows across it. He made one bad mistake. He caught a wheel and went down. If you put in this modified form of comparative negligence, this company from out of state would never have offered him a settlement. We would have gone to trial and we'd have been rolling dice to see if a jury would apportion less than 51% fault on David, who, by the way, took some responsibility for making that mistake. So in our case, SAFE would not have received $513,000 as lien reimbursement, which they got this week. That's how the employer's liability law, if you change it, will work for insurers. It will also make the workplace less safe because it will not require employers and general contractors to really pay for the risks that they take with safety. Safety does cost money. It costs a lot less when you do it right than when you do it wrong, but it will be worse for workers. It will be worse for insurers. And then lastly, employers. David worked for Stoner Electric, a fairly big company in Portland. Stoner Electric, their workers' compensation insurance rates will not be dinged by this huge claim cost because SAFE has gotten all that money back. When they don't get their money back, it goes into the risk assessment for their premiums, and over a five-year period, the claims cost result in higher or lower premiums for employers. Stoner will not have that happen to them because SAFE's been paid back over $500,000. Now, I'm almost done, and I appreciate your patience, but I brought with me this little pile of documents, and what it is a compilation from OSHA of all of the citations for violation of the OSHA codes by this employer, the general contractor out of Vancouver, that I don't intend to do them harm by telling you their name, but they're an out-of-state contractor. There are 183 citations in the last 15 years before Mr. O'Connor was injured. They continued to operate this site after David fell in exactly the same manner as they did beforehand. They never covered the holes, and they were all over the premises. This is an out-of-state contractor who is going to benefit if you change this law. There are many people in Oregon that are abiding by safety codes, most of them, because we don't have these many cases. When we have them, they're catastrophic injuries. The reverse is also true. Washington has the employer liability law almost exactly as Oregon has now. Oregon residents who work in Washington get the benefit of that law, and there was a case decided recently where the comp carrier from Washington got its full lien back when the brain-injured Oregon resident settled a case against the Washington contractor. Almost the same facts: tip over, fall on the ground, get catastrophically injured. So I guess what I would ask you to consider is that this law, if you change it, will make the workplace more unsafe than it currently is. It will hurt pretty much everybody involved in the picture of how these things work. The financial impact to SAFE, by the way, and the insurers is going to be well in excess of the department's estimates. I mean, Mr. DeZuba and I have two cases that total over $1 million in reimbursements. Those are just two cases. There is a great financial impact on this around the state, and I would ask that you consider that in this in your review of the bill. And again, thank you very much. I'll just have Mr. O'Connor tell you what happened to him, and we appreciate your time.
I'm Dave O'Connor, member of IBEW. Appreciate you guys allowing us to speak this afternoon. Working for a general contractor, the conditions just weren't real safe. Doing basically my job, what was required of me, and as Steve had mentioned, I took over scissor lift, now incomplete paraplegia now. But basically, I think with this bill, I would agree with Steve, it would give the worker that's injured, basically there would be less chance to be able to settle out of court, and with that at fault, if I was to go to court and I was to be negligible of 51% or more, that would be, I would be not reimbursed for the damages or any compensation. So I think basically there should be some sort of responsibility of the general contractors. I think this bill would keep them from being responsible of the general safety conditions.
Thank you very much. Mr. DeZuba, how do you pronounce your name?
DeZuba.
DeZuba, okay. You gave us a figure that there was an 88, there was 180 some total disability claim settlements, and in 98 there was 13. Is that?
That's correct.
Okay. I don't know why you didn't say why you think the big drop. What is your reasoning for the tenfold drop?
Well, I think that the that there has been an effort within the workers' compensation system to reduce the number of benefits for permanent and total disability that have been granted. You know, Mr. Chair, I might point out that part of what the committee is doing now is addressing some rights that were taken away from workers in 1987 and 1990. And by doing that, what they're doing is asking them to give up other rights to get back some of the rights that they gave up in those 2 years. But I think that there's been a trend. I can give you the figures, and I've known it from the last case that I saw was the Betty T case that narrowed it down to a worker that was doing part-time telemarketing at a minimum wage, and the court said that under the workers' compensation law at present form, she was not entitled to those benefits. But in 1987, there were 177 permanent total disabilities. 1988, there were 195. 1989, there were 124. 1990, there were 45. 1991, there were 46. 1992, there were 42. 1993, there were 13. 1994, there were 27. 1995, there were 15. 1996, there were 11. 1997, there were 15. 1998, there were 10, and 1999, there were 13. And I might add that 1999, there were 47 fatalities in Oregon on the job, too. I can only tell you that it's been a conscious effort within the workers' compensation system to narrow the number of awards.
Well, I guess by my perspective, I would say that the reason that has happened is that because one of the things that happened with the 1990 reforms was not just a change in the system, but an increased emphasis on safety in the workplace, and there are much fewer injuries in the workplace now than there was in 1990 or 1988, and there is much lower incidence of catastrophic injuries in the workplace.
And I think that observation, I respectfully suggest, is not borne out by the fact that workplace fatalities are still running at about one a week. And they have been. They've come down probably a little. The figures I saw before that were in the low 60s, but they've been in the high 40s or low 50s, continuing up to the present time.
But there are much fewer claims totally in the system. And I will recognize that there are fatalities in the workplace, and that's a tragedy, but it's going to happen no matter what we do. But in Oregon right now, I think because of what happened, employers have not just, you know, have seen reduced premiums, they've also invested an enormous amount of money in safety. And we now have a safer place for Oregon workers to work than we did 10 or 12 years ago, in my opinion. And obviously we disagree. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming today. Okay, who else? We have Ross, Dwinnell? Not even close. And Greg Lowell? State your names for the record, and whenever you're ready.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ross Dwinnell, and you didn't miss it by very much, so please don't. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insured Association. I co-chair the legislative committee, and I'm also president of a company, Western Benefits, a small employer in Portland, Oregon. What I would like to do is share with you from the Oregon Self-Insurers Association's perspective, my view. Greg will talk about other sections of the bill that we've delegated out, and I'd like to tell you why we delegated those out, and I'm not here to expand on the entire bill. I want to talk about just the sunsets. Before I do that, I would also like to share some perspective with you just for just a couple of moments that I hope would be helpful. In 1990, along with then-Representative Shiprack, I co-chaired the Mahoney Hall. And at that time, we did develop a package, an agreement. There were seven labor and seven business representatives, and we shook hands and said we weren't going to backslide on the agreement. We asked the legislature to do the same. And for the most part, the legislature, along with the governor and John Kitzhaber, did pass a set of reforms. And at that time, we had anticipated the savings would be somewhere around 10%. The system was in great crisis. The savings were substantially more. And I know you're hearing that there will be a slight cost increase here. I'm concerned that that might be underestimated because of what I want to share with you regarding the synergies of what this bill creates. The department has done a good job. The department has done a good job at giving you an overview of how this bill looks. We would like to provide more testimony in depth about the intricacies of this bill. For this reason, in 1990, we did, Senator, talk about safety, increasing benefits, improving the medical conditions, and lowering the litigation rate. There was a lot to give and take on both sides. And this bill, however, doesn't address those issues. It is more of a intricacies of the system and how the system actually works, as opposed to a policy guideline on how the policy on how the system should work. In 1990, we were in crisis. I don't believe, and our membership doesn't believe, we're in crisis today. That's not to say action shouldn't be taken. That's not to say that changes shouldn't be made. And with that, I'd like now to move on. On the sunset provision, and this will just give you an example of a little bit of the detail. In 1995, the second set of reforms in the 90s, there were two of them that this legislature passed, 1990 package, 1995 Senate, House, along with the governor's input, a bill went through. And in 1995, one of the give and takes of that bill was that the legislature wanted a sunset on permanent partial disability to force labor to come back to the table. And why is that necessary when MLAC is working? Well, at that time, the MLAC committee wasn't functioning at the level that it appears to be today, for whatever reason. And in addressing that, they said that there's always bad cases that come along, and you heard about one today where new medical conditions may be before an employer or insurer or safe. And there's one estimate that that one case alone could cost $200 million. And therefore, these reforms are really important. And I would think that any one case that would cost a system $200 million when the system cost is only $600 million would need to be addressed by the legislature. So the legislature put in the sunset on permanent disability, not trusting these other processes to work and bring labor back to the table so they always have something to talk about. The governor, on the other hand, said, well, if you're going to treat us that way, then we're going to put the changes to exclusive remedy. We're putting a sunset in that. And that's what happened, and that's what is being addressed today. It may make perfectly good sense to eliminate both of them. If they were bargained as a package, and that's your policy decision, if they were bargained as a package, the one difficulty we have, our association has, is that the sunset provision on permanent partial disability has no Supreme Court case hanging over its head that could easily change or remove whatever you decide today. The Smothers case is being reviewed by the Supreme Court that deals only on the issue of exclusive remedy. It has been before the court for over a year, and an opinion is expected. That, if the court does come out with an adverse opinion, that will then undo the balance of this one particular agreement of trading exclusive remedy and the sunset of permanent partial disability. I'd like to now ask, well, I certainly would accept any questions before I end, if there are any. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Go ahead. You must have done a great job. You stopped all questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Greg Lowell. I work for Personnel Source in Eugene, Oregon. I'm on the Oregon Self-Insured Association Board, and I've been a workers' compensation claims examiner since 1987, and that's currently what I do. I want to speak first about the interim medical concept that's been introduced in this bill, and I think Mr. Shiprack explained the problem very well, that we have situations where employees who have health insurance and they have workers' comp insurance, have an injury of some sort, need medical care, and no one steps to the plate to accept the claim and provide the benefit. And they slip through the cracks and can't get their medical care covered. It's a real problem. The question I think we have to answer is, okay, someone needs to step up. Who should it be? And if you look at the way workers' comp medical benefits are paid, they're paid at 100%. There's no copayments. There's no deductibles. It's the best medical insurance there is. The workers' compensation fee schedule also pays higher than health insurance reimbursement rates. And the solution that's arrived here is the workers' compensation insurance will be primary. It will pay first. And if the claim is ultimately denied and found non-compensable, then the workers' comp insurer can go after health insurance, and then they can go after the employee for reimbursement. And let me explain to you a specific example of how this might work and what the impact is. We had an employee at a manufacturing plant recently, came down with some pain in his side. We didn't know what it was. We took him to the hospital. He got a bunch of tests worked up, x-rays, CAT scans. Turned out he had kidney stones. Not a work-related problem, but it took about $2,500 to figure that out. Under this bill, we'd pay that as a workers' compensation cost because the claim was filed at the hospital. We'll seek reimbursement through the health care insurance. Now, the health care insurance probably has some different contracted rate with that medical facility that's lower than the workers' comp fee schedule. So we get reimbursement from the health insurance, and maybe we get $1,500 back. Still $1,000 there, and we can go after the employee for that. Whereas if this employee had gone into the hospital and put it through simply on health insurance, $1,500 gets paid, everybody walks away, maybe he's got a small copayment or deductible, but he's not facing a $1,000 garnishment that we could go after. So the problem we have here is that you're making workers' compensation, which is the richest medical benefit we have, the primary payer on a claim that may ultimately be non-compensable.
You lost me someplace, and I don't know. Obviously, it was my mind went someplace, but anyway, the now you said your company would be on the hook for $1,500 if this bill goes into effect, that you could go back.
Well, as a workers, Mr. Chairman, as a workers' comp insurer and a claims administrator, we're going to have to pay on an pay the interim medical the $2,500 or whatever the workers' comp fee schedule tells us to pay. But we're not necessarily guaranteed under this bill that the health insurance is going to pay us back at the same rate we paid the doctor. So there's some money left over that we can
be. Is that because of the deductibles and copays, or is that because differing rates that insurances pay to doctors?
Both. So I think you need to look really hard at whether you want workers' compensation, which pays a rich medical benefit, to be the first payer on one of these disputes where it's a question of whether it's work-related or not.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perkins.
Well, as to the richness of the workers' comp part of it. I mean, you're talking about a compensable injury for work-related injury, so I'm not sure that's a fair apples and orange comparison with a deductible health insurance plan. Wasn't there someone from the self-insured group in part of the negotiations for this bill?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, the there was a member, Hoffman Construction, which is a member of the Self-Insured Association, had a representative on the group of six.
Yes. And are you guys coming in now opposing the bill because of the provisions that you raised?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, yes, we have real concerns about the bill.
Okay.
Make sure I'm clear with your analysis. The doctors currently are told, I mean, maybe not so many words, but, and there's somebody else can ask this question if you can't, but they're told what they're going to charge, what they're going to get reimbursed at by health insurance. We're going to give you X number of dollars for whatever it is procedure. But under workers' comp, the doctors bill at whatever rate they wish, and the insurer is required to reimburse at that rate?
Mr. Chairman, the workers' comp insurer will pay at the workers' compensation fee schedule, which is a schedule that's set by the state, by the workers' comp department.
And is that fee schedule significantly lower than what private insurers pay?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure exactly what all private insurers pay. My understanding is the workers' comp fee schedule is higher than what typical health insurance reimbursement is.
Okay, and that fee schedule, just a second, that fee schedule is set by who? The workers' comp fee schedule.
Mr. Chairman, it's set by it's a fee schedule published by the state. I'm not exactly sure who sets it, but it's published as a document by the Workers' Compensation Department.
I just got to answer the question.
I'd like to, if I can, just talk about one other problem in the intramedical situation. There's no provision in here for the workers' comp insurer to not pay on a fraudulent claim. For example, I could go into the hospital tomorrow, say I've got a sore back, and say that I work for Schnitzer Steel. Well, I don't work for Schnitzer Steel, but I could file a claim against them. And by the time that claim hits the desk of the claims administrator for Schnitzer Steel, time is going on, I'm receiving medical care, and the way this statute is written, from the time I file the claim until the time they can get a denial out, they have to pay those interim medical benefits. There's a difference we have in what they call interim compensation, where the insurer has 14 days to either start paying or deny the claim. And if they deny the claim within 14 days, they don't have to pay anything on the time loss side. But on the medical side, we don't have any window of opportunity to look at a claim and say, we're not going to pay anything. Because this statute is written from the time the claim is filed until the time the claim is denied, those benefits are interim medical benefits and would be covered.
Okay.
So I think it opens it up for some significant abuse or fraud.
Do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of the situation that you talked about with the manufacturing, the individual at the manufacturing plant. Well, I guess first, what is the rationale for the difference in the two, the workers' comp, which is a more generous payout than the normal health care payout?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckert, my understanding is the difference, the higher rate paid by workers' compensation, if you'd ask a lot of doctors, they would say that workers' compensation is more costly to administer, a higher paperwork burden, and, you know, they have to provide return to work information and increases their administrative costs, and they feel they need a higher reimbursement for that. A couple of years ago, there was actually a movement to make the workers' comp fee schedule about the same as the health care reimbursement schedule, and the doctors fought it very hard.
That fee schedule, we can get this confirmed by the someone else if you can advance, but that is just set by rule, if not a statutory provision. that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, you do another question on the record.
And so, just for clarity for us on the point that you made in terms of the incentive today, you would claim, is for the individual, that individual, to access the health care system because he or she would benefit fully. And if we pass this, that same individual, then if they chose to access the more generous workers' comp system, would be in a position where they would have possibly $1,000 in that circumstance garnishment of their wages. So that, just for clarity, and then I guess my question is how often today are we seeing the circumstance where the employee is in a position where their wages are being garnished? Is that real prevalent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, currently we're not seeing the wages garnished by the workers' comp insurer because there is no garnishment provision in the current law. Under the proposed law, that could happen. As to how many people out there this would affect, I'm not real sure how big a problem that is. I consider that kind of I think it's an important point here. I think the more important point was maybe my second point, which I could have brought up first, which is that claims are filed and they'll be paid whether or not they're work-related until a denial goes out.
And didn't you say in your example that today you would garnish, on your example, you would garnish that employee's wages for $1,000?
Not in today's law.
Not in today's law.
Well, that would be under the bill's
math.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you guys agree that there's a problem in this, the kid gets hurt and there's a period of time right now where nobody pays the bills?
Yeah.
Is that a problem in your perspective?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, I believe it is a problem. I don't know how widespread it is, but when the system breaks down and somebody needs treatment and the workers' comp insurer says, I'm deferred, I haven't made a decision, and the health care insurance won't provide any authorization at the same time, yeah, that's a problem.
Okay, we've offered one solution. What do you suggest?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think we should have workers' compensation insurance paying for non-work-related medical problems. And I think we're opening the door to that with this legislation. And then I don't know that I have a real specific answer, but I would sure like to not see workers' compensation, which pays that higher rate, be the primary payer.
No, you don't get a choice. Give me a solution. We don't need it right now, but
okay.
You see where we're coming from. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
We got a problem out there. We agree there's a problem. Let's work toward a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Harper, I appreciate your line of inquiry because this is what I want this hearing to do both today and Friday is to identify problems in the bill, identify some possible solutions that have not been addressed yet that we can then ship over to the MLAC process and let them look at the some other alternatives to what this bill says.
Mr. Chair, I can take a hint.
Have you been, and I did not ask the last group this, and it's my fault, I was going to make a point to ask every group, but have you been through the MLAC process? Have you been to MLAC and testified in front of MLAC and brought up these issues to them? Okay, so
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have.
Thank you. And so when we ship your concerns over there with this whole issue, I rest assured I think they will then listen to the concerns and look at the problems.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I want to address very briefly two other points. The changes in Section 10 regarding modified duty. Our basic concern here is that we're developing ways now for workers to not come back to work. And
which one, excuse me.
Section 10, where there are now some opportunities for workers to refuse modified employment. And our basic concern is that we'd like to continue to see disability costs reduced and the pain and suffering of a workers' comp injury reduced. I'm a little concerned that we're opening the door now for ways for people not to come back to work as opposed to encouraging return to work efforts. And in regard to Section 13, the multiple jobs time loss issue, we think there are some significant administrative costs that are going to be borne by the workers' compensation insurers, and ultimately that gets passed back to the employers in processing disability payments on regarding wages over employers that they have really no contact, influence, or control over. And I think there are some... I'm very sympathetic to the problem because there are people out there without a full income who are injured on a part-time job, but there may be some other ways to do that outside of the workers' compensation system, because Workers' Compensation Claims Administration is a pretty expensive way to solve a problem.
But, no, I'm not going to ask any more questions.
No, I encourage you to keep asking questions. I just want to make sure we're getting these down while we're asking them.
And thank you for allowing me to speak to you.
Thank you very much. I just want to make sure I'm very clear in what the questions are and what the answers are, so when we go forward with this, we got all these. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've got David Wheeler. Is there anyone else who is not going to be able to return on Friday to testify because we had scheduled until 6, and it's quite obvious we're not going to get through everyone on the list today. So if there's anyone else who cannot come back on Friday to testify and feels they have to talk today, please come up now. Otherwise, we'll just we'll probably have Mr. Wheeler, and then we'll quit for the night and continue on Friday.
What time are you starting on Friday?
3 p.m.
I can't be.
We're ending at 4:15.
Mr. Wheeler, please come up.
Yes, that's 3:15 on Friday, 3 o'clock on Friday when we're not meeting. And I don't even live in...
Where do you guys live?
You live in Northern California, don't you?
See if we can get you out of here by 6 anyway. I'm Dave Wheeler. I work for PCC Structurals, Inc. I'm their senior staff consultant. We represent 3,000 employees in the state of Oregon, and I also am the overseer of the workers' comp systems in 14 states for Precision Cast Parts, and that's 14,500 employees. Multiple state experience and a long time experience within the workers' comp system here. I'm also one of those poor souls that wants to tell you there are alternate ways of looking at costs within this bill. And after the build-up earlier today, that might be difficult. I'd like to share that I've listened to Mr. Shiprock's testimony both in public hearings and here. I've actually checked it out, and he's right. His group has experienced denials. And I think, from the limited amount of research that I've done, his group has experienced denials inappropriately. In fact, when we're looking at our whole testimony sit here and the questions why we're actually even doing reform, the word denial or processing of denials comes up repetitively. I would like to refer you, before I get into my 2 points, that there is a very good report out by the department on the internet on claims reporting history, what's accepted, what's not accepted, what type of claims accepted, and how many denials are actually overturned. To give you a brief summary, the last data in this report, which was published in February of 1998, there was 47,000 claims that occurred during 1997. Just over 20,000 of those were denied. I have problems with that because I handle with 3,000 people. We are processing maybe about 300 claims, and we might deny 10 in the course of the year. We get further into this report on the last page, and we start looking on what's called where you go to appeal your denials. And in that appeal process, a full 70% of the denials that were placed out by the insurance companies were overturned or settled. In my experience, I normally settle the denials when we've made a mistake and we want to get out of it at a minimum amount of its cost or with not being exposed to the full potential of the claim. So, gentlemen and ladies, I would propose to you that perhaps one of the problems that we're having with our current system isn't necessarily legislative, it's quality. And at no point have I seen in the legislative efforts that have been done so far and in the hard work that the Group of Six has done so far, have we addressed quality of the claims reviewed. With 70% of these claims being changed, that means 70% of the denials that were actually into the claims review process had errors in them that existed within existing statute. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally have a problem with that. One of the reasons, since we're self-insured, is when we make an error, it isn't financially impactful to our company to have made that error in fine or an additional penalty. And in some cases, it might even be to our advantage to take the penalty, make the error, and delay payment. I would suggest to you that one of the things that IMLAC or you as a group could consider is to take a look at the cost of making an error and review that cost. And where does it become impactful for the insurers? And at what point would the insurers be exerting additional quality and efforts in the work as they look at a claim for denial? I know that when my group is working on denials, they're instructed that they must have at least three strong points. It didn't happen at work. They have objective medical evidence that it isn't a workers' compensation claim. And they know that they are in a strong position to be successful in the defense of their denial. And if they aren't in that position, they are not to deny, period. And that's consequently why we have so many denials compared, you know, only 10 out of 300. And when I take the extension of 20,000 to 47,000. So that aside, I really suggest to you that perhaps the problem that we have is not necessarily a system that's broken, but a system that's not being run and monitored well. That editorial comment was not planned. I would like to take to you those statistics and give you a simple way that you yourself can analyze some of the costs that are in this without relying on the 1.5% or the 2% comments on a $600 million claim space. The easy way is to take the report that I just referred to you, which you can readily access on the Internet, and just do some of the simple extensions.
Do you have the Internet site for that report? Is that...
Senator Beyer, I have the report, and I can produce it to your clerk, and the address is on the bottom.
Thank you.
And it's by the department. The other thing that I'm concerned about within the legislature is something that I sense, which is dividing the worker from the employer. I know it's hokey and probably won't go over well, but we're an employer that's very concerned about relationships with our employees. And is it because of soft ethics? No, folks. It's because they're hard to come by, and we have to train them. And we have to spend a lot of time invested in them to be able to get them into a position where they'll be able to produce a successful product for us. And at 3% or 4% unemployment rate, those folks are hard to find. Consequently, we are highly invested in protecting our employees and making sure that things are done right, and we are sensitive to whenever something is coming across on a legislative basis that drives a wedge between us and our employer. I would like to refer to you in, I believe it's Section 12, page 18, the what we have affectionately referred to as the worker statement. This is an opportunity for a worker in a deposition basis to actually explain their case to the insurer or to the hearing officer on an order and review. In other words, something that's being looked over, they're not happy with the decision, and they want to have something to say about it. On the top of it, it sounds very nice. The methodology of how we actually achieve this goal is extremely expensive. We're estimating right now that in a deposition mode, which means I have to have my lawyer present and the court claimant has to have their lawyer present, and we have to have a court reporter present, and we have to do a transpose the entire conversation. And frankly, the lawyers aren't going to be real nice to the worker because they're going to be challenging some of the statements and questions he has to be able to get a statement out. By the time you figure that you have a couple hours prep time, you've got to pay the employee time, you've got to pay the lawyers, it's somewhere between $125 and $175 an hour, you're looking at a possible $3,000 cost for a worker statement. The availability of making this statement exists today in the form of a letter. And if there is question on whether the letter was actually written by the employee, you can actually do what's called a deposition, dispositive statement. where they, as filled out and witnessed by either a notary public, etc., that statement by the worker can be provided to the hearing officer, and the hearing officer, being the human that they are, will read that statement, and the same impacted information can be delivered. And the worker doesn't need to be cross-examined in the inquisition style the depositions occasionally get to. They can simply state what they need to have said and to get it into the record. They also have available to them that they can get the information across in their medical record, and they can get their information across in a hearing if it really becomes necessary to do that. When you take $3,000 to do this process, and then we looked at that in 1997, there was 4,995 events that were in the order on review basis, then we could possibly be looking at, if everybody did this report, almost $14, almost $15 million spent. I won't bore you because I've actually given you those numbers on 100% utilization. And people say, well, why would they want to do that? In the legislation, as it's written, we have an interesting phrase, and it says that the insurer or self-insured will bear all costs of the deposition. And if I was the employee's lawyer, I think this is really neat, because that means I can now do this deposition, I can bill for my time and bill for the presence during the questioning and be paid. Right now, if I'm in the workers' compensation as a lawyer, I have to effect a change to the claim, add a condition, or affect the award for before I'm able to receive a formatted and formulated payment. Consequently, this device, if I was a lawyer, I think it would be really nice, because I could cover my overhead expenses real quick by making sure that everyone who comes to me makes sure they have a worker's statement to be made to the group. And once again, as an employer worried about the assets and trainings that we're spending on our employee base, we immediately start to see a division, because I have a worker who has a need to say something about the reality of their perception of their claim, and it's being done in a hostile setting. I would welcome the worker to tell us about it or write it in a letter in a non-hostile setting. And if they want to go ahead and use a lawyer, I think they could probably do this whole letter affair for $50. In which case, that would cost somewhere around $250,000, or just about 4% of the cost of the lowest estimate that I've given you of $3,746,250 for only 25% of the people availing themselves to this right.
So this is your recommended solution or change, because, correct me if I'm wrong, the courts have said the workers have a right to speak.
I agree, and I think they should speak.
So, rather than speak in a deposition, you are saying let them submit a letter as a solution or as an alternative to this. How about let them appear and tell their side of the story?
If you're writing a I don't have this format down, so apologize if I do not use the etiquette that's proper for a committee. I'm kind of a direct person, and I'm sorry. But in the writing of a letter, you have an opportunity to sit down on a quiet reflection, without having your thoughts rattled by controversial questions or implications about whether you're credible or not, and you can get your items down. There are people who can't write, and I appreciate that. Also, when you're into the O&O situation, you're normally represented. Your lawyers can write. If you can't, you've hired the wrong lawyer. And this gives you an opportunity to get this device thoughtfully, slowly, without conflict, and without the possibility of public error speaking, which is very terrifying for people. If you look at some of the psychological studies, there are two things people fear. The first they fear most is death. The second they fear most is public speaking. And I feel, from my own perspective, that a letter or an assisted letter is a more humane way to deliver my opinion to a group that, instead of having the eye contact and the confrontation of a lawyer's hostile setting or getting into a hearing officer setting. Folks, it's $50. They can get the same information across. They can do it without dying.
Okay. What is your rationale? I mean, the number we have for cost by this section by the department is about $100,000, I think, is not the right number. You're saying you're guessing somewhere between 15 and 8 million, or 4 million and 15 million.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a brain surgeon, but there seems to be a little difference there between those numbers.
Well, sir, there's a difference, and John and I have had honest and frank discussions about the approach for cost analysis altogether. Think about the motivators of what drives something to happen, and why would you utilize a device? If you were a lawyer, you're able to obtain fees and payments from the insurer or self-insured that were not available to you without prevailing in a court hearing. Consequently, from an overhead point of view, I would encourage my claimants to make this deposition. You can take your assumptions that you would like. There was just under 5,000 cases in the study year that were in this area of effect. And if I was a young lawyer and I was able to get a hold of 300 of those, I think I would have 80 or 90% of those 300 make this deposition because they represent a revenue opportunity without actually achieving an end goal. Now, I'm not maligning lawyers. Frankly, if you have a revenue opportunity that's uncontrolled and you need to be able to maintain your overhead expense, I think you take advantage of it. Consequently, those are my figures. And you can see where the numbers came from, and it came off of the report. They're within the order and review group, and the cost figure OSIA and I have worked up, and I've given you the background of why I think it's that many dollars per event. Things that weren't considered in the cost. They weren't anybody over $150 an hour. We didn't consider the fact that anywhere between 25% and a third of all depositions are canceled and rescheduled. And in the vagueness of this section, it says all costs. It doesn't say all reasonable costs, or it doesn't say general practice costs. Consequently, if I was again in this lawyer mode, I would probably want to go ahead and prep again for 2 hours if I had to go again for the canceled appointment. And then you have your exposure. That's how that money came together, and that's why it's different from the state. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes, it does. And then have you been to MLAC also? I forgot to ask that question.
Yes, sir. I've been following this issue with due diligence since July of the year 2000.
Did you testify to MLAC?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Workers' garnishment issue is another divisive issue between the employer and the employee. I am, and I'm going to have all the OSIA people stab me at this next moment, in support of doing interim med payments to the employee. I am in support of obtaining funds from the insurance company, and that's where I stop. I am not in support of garnishing the worker. The reason I'm not in support of the garnishing worker is this is a no-fault system. If I have to now have every one of my employees be aware of all aspects of the law about what is an acceptable claim or what is not an acceptable claim before they can make a risk theory assessment of obtaining treatment for a workers' compensation or an injury at work, I have defeated my purposes. I've had people delay a couple of days just because they wanted to get their safety award, had a finger become infected and required an amputation. I certainly don't need the additional pressure of having workers not necessarily seeking treatment for medical conditions and then in worry of being able to afford to pay for this and then have additional complications develop. We are managed within a managed care organization, and as an organization, we pay interim meds. It does increase our overhead expense for workers' compensation, and it is something as a company that we can and do bear. If I garnish a worker's wages and I'm being insured by an outside insurer, the outside insurer no longer has an employee-employer relationship concern with the worker. What they are doing is attempting to subrogate against the worker's rights within the insurance policy, and by doing that, recover some of their costs. I pay them a premium, they take care of that, and then they tell me through a judgment order, which I really can't refuse, by the way, because it is a judgment order, to garnish John or Jane's wages to seek repayment. In a self-insured basis, I have a lot more control over that because I can choose not to seek the wages back or the cost back. But workers' compensation expenses, the number of injuries that are paid, the initial treatments from 0 to 14 or 30 days it takes to make a quick assessment about what is and isn't a good claim most of the time, isn't a high financial burden to be borne. So I do agree that the intramed concept is good. I do agree that the insurance companies dodge their expenses as often as they can because they do it by policy contract. And what they want to do is be able to obtain the lowest cost product that they can, sell me a premium cost, and make a profit on the premium dollar that I give them. I don't begrudge them that. That's the insurance industry. But in the mean process, they also have blind contract segments that specifically state until a workers' compensation claim is officially denied and through all appeal process, there will be no payment to the worker for any of the medical benefits that they have incurred. We also have a new development, and whenever we're working in legislation, we need to keep track of what the other industry is doing. This is a photocopy that I've provided you from the Oregon Health Forum paper. It's kind of the rag that keeps track of everybody's health insurances. It appears that our friend at the sisters group, Province Health Plan, has determined that HMOs is no longer profitable for them, and they are actually going to be dismantling the HMO process and going to what's called an EPO, an exclusive provider organization. This is interesting, but it should be in effect somewhere around the year 2002. The other interesting point is ODS and Regency Blue Cross and Blue Shield have agreed that they also are moving towards this product. What is significant about this? The significant aspect is that the EPO contract concept is actually going back several years, if not a decade, back to the 80-20 plan, where you had a family deductible, and then you had 80% paid and 20% was yours on any medical bill. If I subrogate against a worker's insurance policy and I'm in an EPO mode, I can only go after and recover what is rightfully due to the worker. Consequently, if John or Jane Doe, between the first 3 months and 4 months of the policy period, and they have not met their family deductible, which could be as much as $1,800, is going to have first dollar paid to me as I subrogate against their health plan. And once they have met their health deductible, have made their payment, then I'm looking at 80% back with a 20% gap. Folks, if you even considered all the denied claims that occurred in 1997, which was approximately 20,000 claims involving both time loss issues and medical issues, that would mean that I probably have a population of around 20,000 people that could fall into this group. And if the EPO concept or the insurance concepts continue to develop, then these folks are going to have first dollar exposure. And let's assume they covered half of their expenses to begin with, and they only have $1,000 deductible left. Take 20,000 times $1,000, and that is the employee expense. And you can see that real quickly that if you go on to page 2, that has a top of $20,220,000 and as low as $5 million. But it arguably could not be a system's cost because the insurer or self-insured is recovering the expense from the worker. But I think you would have a difficult time explaining to the worker why it isn't a cost to him or her. And consequently, for the employee relations, bad news that you get from the garnishment, because I don't know if you folks have ever worked with employees that were garnished. They're not excited about the process of losing part of their paycheck. And to explain to them that we are garnishing their wages because they didn't necessarily understand all the aspects of the workers' compensation law. And by the way, we're taking this money, we're paying in, if I want to be rude, safe. They're not going to like that. And if I'm self-insured, it's even worse because now I'm taking money from my own employee. I now have a divisive element that exists within the law that drives a wedge between the employer and the employee. Very few people benefit from this condition.
Senator Harper.
So the only problem you have with this interim expenses is the garnishment aspect?
Absolutely.
So everything else is...
Okay. It is a workable proposal minus the garnishment because I don't expect all my employees to be fully knowledgeable of all the aspects of the law. And will I get hit and ripped off? Yes, I will. Will there be situations where I have to pay more than I should? Yes, I will. But I also have to protect the assets of my employee. I have a chance to see this on a global basis because I'm also working with the director of the HR. I'm working about whether we are working on a unionization basis or a non-unionization basis, and with the hiring, firing, health benefits of the employee. So when I'm looking at this problem, I'm looking at it from a total picture for the expense to the company, not just to the workers' comp front.
Why wouldn't that be an individual company's decision?
At this particular moment, you're giving the ability of the insurer, which I do not have control over if I'm paying premium to their behavior.
Okay, I got you.
They get to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea, and it's certainly on the surface a good balance between management getting their money back. But in the essence, what you're doing is you're spending it in another spot.
But with self-insured, which is what your company is, you do have that option of whether or not you want to go back and garnish or not, correct?
We would choose not to garnish.
My point is that the individual self-insured companies would have that option, and the basic nature of a self-insured company is that it's a large company, very many employees, and probably, 80-90% of your employees are also covered by a health plan of some kind or another?
Yes.
So you do have a different dynamic in your industry versus my industry, for example, where a lot of migrant labor, temporary labor, not self-insured, not benefits to health care for the most part, and for most of my employees don't have health care benefits because they're not with me long enough, a lot of minimum wage or near minimum wage jobs. So I am in a different position than a self-insured employer as an employee, because the insurer, in my case, probably won't be able to go back and garnish those wages even if he wants to because of these conditions of my workplace.
No, sir. That's not correct.
How could...
You were fine right up to where you're saying the insurer could not obtain a garnishment. The insurer may not garnish your employee at your location because it was temporary in nature and left. They could obtain a money judgment against that individual that would pursue them in the form of a garnishment from one employee or one employer to the next employer. A lot of times garnishments are for failure to pay health care or a divorce issue. And if John or Jane Doe is working at your facility for 4 weeks, the garnishment attempts to be in place for 4 weeks, and when they move to XYZ manufacturing or XYZ 7-Eleven store, then the garnishment would travel with them and they would attempt to enforce the garnishment judgment at that location. So it will follow the employee as long as there is a legitimate tax-paying payroll system in operation.
Provided that employee is making above minimum wage. I believe, and I'm not an attorney, but you cannot garnish to below minimum wage standards.
I also am not an attorney, and I must apologize to the last time I talked to you about exclusive remedy. I was wrong. You were right. So we are in a situation where, you know, the legal fronts are quite complex.
Questions? Do you have more?
I think I wound down, and these folks want to go home.
Thank you very much for coming in today. Appreciate your testimony, and we will
relay
your concerns to them.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. Committee members, we have some people left on our list. Hopefully we won't have an extremely long day on Friday, but we will be meeting. But Mr. Putman is passing out now. As I asked independently two different attorneys to go through this bill and tell us what the top three things that workers get and the top three things that employers get out of this bill. These attorneys work independently of each other without consultation to each other. I did this just to help us to understand the complexity of workers' comp and to try to help us understand what this bill does. So that's what this document is. One more thing for us to look at.
Just a question on that, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you have the names of the attorneys there?
They're not on the document.
I realize that.
I will let those attorneys come forward and talk to you if they wish. I'll ask them if they want their names put out.
Okay.
And if they do, then we will. I don't know for sure if they do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that in order to give full consideration to the information, I would certainly want to know who the attorneys are, and most certainly their names.
I understand, and I didn't ask that question of them if these were anonymous or if these were, you know, whatever. So I will get you that information unless for some reason they say absolutely not.
Okay.
And then we'll work through that another way.
Yeah. I would even say, depending on the information, if there's an opportunity to have them testify, let's keep that as an option.
Certainly. And I think that they will both agree to tell us who they are, but I didn't ask that question. So before I go down that road, I want to make sure that they're okay with that.
Sure.
Because I'm pretty sure they both plan on being involved in the whole process here.
Okay.
So, thank you, committee members, and everyone who came in today, and we will continue.
Can I talk now?